Boys.
Well, so speaking of homeboys, tell the truth, I've never been so unprepared for a talk as today. I just slapped something together a moment ago. But anyway, to some extent, this isn't intended to be sort of a freestanding talk. I was basically trying to fit into discussions that that we had today, in particular. So, especially so the first part of the talk, in a way, is going to be a continuation of what Frank Ulliher was talking about, when was it, on Tuesday, when he was talking about the problem of wing size determination. So I'll go back to that and give a sort of mechanocentric view on the same problem. And so that's going to be the modeling side of the talk, and then I'll jump and talk about some experimental results that actually have little to do with flies. The work was done in collaboration with Lars Nagel, who was a postdoc here, Alberto Lepita, who was a postdoc here, both have moved on. Actually, many more people that I'll sort of acknowledge at the end, and Kevin Chu, who is a graduating student. So, anyway, Frank already started talking about the size determination problem, and of course the size determination problem, so organ size determination problem, or limb size determination problem, has been mentioned before in the context, of course, of regulation of growth and patterning, and that is what makes it relevant to the problem of cancer, since cancer is misregulation or dysregulation of development. Here we're talking about normal development, and of course in normal development what we see is so perfectly normal organisms, you know, flies in this particular context, that can have a natural variation in size, but so perfectly patterned nevertheless. So this natural variation in size can be exaggerated by certain mutations. For example, one can make larger flies by mutating certain genes that result in larger cells. So these flies basically have larger cells, but more or less the same number, and the whole thing is perfectly well made and functional. Or there are some other mutations that lead to overproliferation of cells, and then the cells are smaller, and the whole thing is perfectly fine and fly. Larger. So the whole thing just is scaled up. But on the other hand, the size isn't just determined by the size of cells or the number of cells. There is clear evidence of a rather intricate feedback going on. And this is actually very nicely illustrated by the following amusing experiment. So what you're looking at here is the wing disk. So this is what the adult fly wing looks like in the larva. Doesn't look anything like the wing. It just looks like a two-dimensional epithelial layer of cells, and that's why people like studying it, because, you know, it's nice and simple. Frank already explained that it actually has two territories, anterior and posterior, which express different genes, and in particular it's possible to target the mutation just to the anterior or posterior part of this. In this way, it's possible to induce a mutation that makes smaller cells just in the anterior part of the disk. So right, that's the normal disk. So here, the cells are smaller, and what has happened is, right, so density is higher, but the disk on the whole is not perturbed at all. And here it's the opposite mutation. Cells have been made larger, they are at lower densities, and the whole thing is pretty much unperturbed. So there is this mechanism which somehow controls the growth. So the big questions are, so how is the growth coordinated with patterning, and how do these limbs and organs know when to stop growing? So in fly development, this wing disc does all its growing pretty much in the larva, where of course it's not functional as a wing. So and there is no growth in the wing after that. So I'm kind of fast forwarding through this story, so I'll just give you a few facts. Again, Frank already told us at greater length how growth is induced by morphogens, and he also explained what the morphogens are, diffusible substances that control patterning in a concentration-dependent fashion. And it turns out that they also control growth. So this is kind of nice, because we were talking about coordination of growth and patterning, and it is sort of reassuring that both would be controlled by the same thing, so at least we can see how the two things are talking to each other. So another fact that Frank actually showed some data for is that observed growth is approximately uniform throughout that disc tissue. It's not growing on the periphery, it's growing throughout, so the whole thing more or less dilating. So there is another fact which I'm not sure whether it got mentioned in the last 2 weeks. So there is this peculiar phenomenon called cell competition, which refers to the following situation. If one creates a clone, i.e. a mutant cell and its progeny, which are going to grow as a sort of localized clump. So if one generates a clone with a deviant rate of growth, for example, faster growing clone, this clone will expand and will kill off neighboring normal wild-type cells. In the opposite situation, where the clone is slower growing, so these clones basically disappear from the tissue. So, but the curious thing is they're not just that the neighbors grow exponentially faster, and they constitute a very small fraction. They really disappear. They apoptote. So there is a sense in which there is a local comparison in the rate of growth that cells are capable of carrying out. So I think I can skip this safely.
So first, what is the maximum number of cells? It first has to grow before it disappears, right?
Yeah.
So how are those clones created if they're slow growing?
Well, so they're created by somatic mutation.
Okay.
So it's possible to induce so somatic recombination, and well, it's actually a sort of beautiful thing which makes flies sort of a convenient experimental organism. So it's actually possible to induce this thing. But, so the statement is one can induce it at a given time by a temperature shock. And then one will find, okay, so these cells will actually be fluorescently labeled. And one day after that, one can find them. So there'll be few cells, right?
So
but if one comes back later, right, one doesn't find them.
But the number is non-clinically decreasing. It doesn't have a maximum.
Yeah. Yeah, it has to have a maximum. It starts with a single cell. So it goes up a little bit, and then they disappear. But
whereas it's actually it's possible to induce mutations even in a localized area with optical means with retinoic acid.
Yeah.
To engage a compound yeah. and just induce a local mutation and see it completely.
Yeah, that's what our friends in Paris built. Right, and the advantage of that is sort of a universal tool. It can be then used in all sorts of animals. Okay, anyway, so very, very schematically, Frank explained that morphogens are secreted by specialized cells. Well, actually, in the disk, it's a line of cells that secretes morphogen, but we'll just look at the one-dimensional cut through it. So there is your morphogen secreted, diffusing around. There is presumably degradation. Simple dimensional analysis will tell you that there is some length scale where some diffusive transport is balanced by the rate of degradation, and roughly you expect some sort of an exponential profile. And then we know that morphogens are needed for growth. So you'll say, okay, so the size is determined right here, right? Too far from the source, these guys here will not be dividing because they're probably not getting enough morphogen. So the only problem with that, okay, so basically, according to this little scenario, if you start with a small clump of tissue, right, and the disk starts actually very small, just 50 cells, then it will grow happily until it becomes much larger than the scale of morphogen diffusion, and then the whole thing might stop growing, except the only problem is that the cells in the periphery know how far they are from the source, but the cells near the source do not. So in order to really inhibit growth in the disk, you need some means of communication, right? Some way that the cells in the periphery could communicate with the cells close to the source. And of course, biologists naturally think of various biochemical means by which this signaling can happen. And people have been looking for chemical messengers for a long time. So, for example, what Frank mentioned, well, I guess more than mentioned, because it was sort of the key ingredient of the model he discussed. The one possibility is that there is something conserved in the disk, which when the disk expands, right, since it's conserved, the concentration goes down as 1 over the area. And then if that particular conserved molecule is required for growth, then if there is sort of a simple threshold, then it will signal growth arrest at the right time. So people have been looking for things like this for quite a while. And as far as I know, haven't found them. And as I promised, I'm going to give sort of mechanocentric alternative of that. So let's think about what mechanics can do for us. But in doing so, first, useful to remember about this cell competition. See, in population genetics, there's clone competition. So I keep thinking clone competition, but no, it's cell competition. So there is this mechanism that I told you about where a clump of cells can compare growing at a deviant rate can interact with the neighbors. And of course, if you think about mechanical implications of unequal growth in some local patch and its surrounding, obviously this is going to generate stresses, and the stress generated by non-uniform growth can then give us the feedback signal. So you just do a little back of the envelope estimate. So assuming that, it's not even an estimate. Before we do that, I have to give you another fact. So we know that there is rather little rearrangement of cells in this tissue. So there is very little exchange of neighbors that has been observed. So in a sense, you expect these epithelial cells then to behave as more or less elastic solid, at least on short time scale. Of course, on the longer time scale, they can rearrange their cytoskeleton and relieve the stress, right? But if they relieve the stress, they'll keep the deformation. So continuing with on the back of the envelope, you convince yourself that if the local rate of growth is different from the average rate of growth, you expect the pressure to increase or decrease with time. So I'm very sloppy. So talking about pressure, what I really mean is uniaxial stress, but I really don't want to carry tens of indices around. Not worth it. Good.
Are you distinguishing here, this is not a homeostatic pressure of what you call a local pressure?
Well, homeostatic pressure, no, I really mean stress.
You mean stress, just old-fashioned lumbar jets, mechanical stress.
Yeah, at the moment, yes.
Boris, on time scale, you're talking about 6 hours, or that separates rearrangement of cytoskeleton?
Yeah, a couple hours, a few hours.
Okay, so,
let's see, where were we? Okay. So we decided that local stress depends on the history of local growth. Now, let's assume that the rate of growth, and therefore local dilation, depends also on pressure. Okay, and it doesn't really matter very much how it depends on pressure. We're going to say that too much pressure or too much tension is going to suppress the rate of growth. So we have something with maximum. Actually, I somewhat purposefully shifted the maximum in the region of negative pressure, i.e. tension. There is evidence that tensile stress actually facilitates growth. So anyway, so now suppose you have this local clone, right, local patch that is trying to grow faster than the average, right, in its unstressed state, right? So this is positive, pressure is going to start increasing, and all right, local conditions are going to basically shift to the right here, and this will continue until the two rates get to be equal. So we have this little fixed point here. You can convince yourself that the opposite happens on the other side. And actually, this fixed point would be unstable. So,
Boris, can you kind of maybe somehow at least occasionally move?
So oh, I'm sorry. I'm
not transparent.
That's because I'm armed with a stick and I'm right-handed. So anyway, so we have this what engineers call integral feedback, which is actually a feedback of choice. It really doesn't depend on just about anything. All one needs is sufficiently long memory there. And so here we have a mechanism where, which would basically favor uniform growth. Okay. So we can turn this back of the envelope argument into simulation, but I'm going to skip that and just try to tell you how this idea could work as a mechanism of size determination. Okay. So we just talked about the feedback dependence, the rate of growth on local stress. So that is entirely hypothetical. We don't really know about that. But what we do know is that the rate of self-proliferation does depend on morphogen concentration. Again, it doesn't really matter how. It only increases monotonically and probably has a threshold. And that's our hypothetical feedback dependence on the pressure. Now, let's play a little game. Again, great oversimplification. I'm not really going to try to model the growth of imaginal disk. There are too many assumptions around, not worth the trouble. So let's just do the simplest model possible. We'll say that there is basically axisymmetric morphogen, which is secreted by our favorite cell chosen somewhere in the middle. And I don't know if you can see it. You are supposed to see a little bit of green here, which actually codes for concentration of the morphogen. Anyway, there's more morphogen, obviously, in the vicinity of the source, and then vaguely exponential decay away from it, and there is some characteristic length scale associated with it. That's what we put in here. And we're going to, we have put together a little simulation of dividing cells. What's actually simulated is we and others call it vertex model, some lattice elastic Hamiltonian, which then minimizes some elastic energy. So we can actually calculate local stress on cells, and you will find that there's a distribution of local stresses, and red is compressed, blue is stretched, and we have the situation where there's more morphogen, and therefore it's trying to drive faster growth close to the center. That builds up pressure. So you see, on average, more red here. Yep. And then, of course, it is stretching the periphery.
I see more red in a kind of annulus. At the origin, I see less red. Or am I just imagining?
Well, yes, you're imagining. on average. I mean, there's a lot of heterogeneity, right? It's a disordered lattice, so there is a lot of local fluctuations. But anyway,
of course, in the bounds is usually very irregular, right?
Yeah, I mean that's just sort of an artifact
of the model.
Yeah, so it's just a free boundary condition here, and division is stochastic. So just Poisson process with a rate, which depends on the morphogen and pressure.
So there's another surface test you have to introduce to get us.
Yeah, but the whole thing is not a free boundary. I mean, right. Okay. So, all right. We're close to Hollywood, so I'm going to show a movie. So what you're looking here is the simulation in action. So these dots mark sort of freshly divided, basically daughter cells. And now the growth is over, and I'll run it again. Right. So basically, of course, what's happening is it is trying to grow faster in the middle, building up more stress. The stress is then suppressing the growth. And on the whole, if there's a lot of fluctuations, you do it many times, you average, you look at the distribution of cell divisions as a function of the radius, and you convince yourself that it's actually pretty uniform. But what's happening is the pressure in the center of the disk is increasing. Eventually it gets to be high enough that it suppresses the growth where there is the morphogen, right? And of course, in the periphery, there is no pressure, but there is also no morphogen, right? So the whole thing has stopped growing because it is compressed in the middle, and because it doesn't have a morphogen in the periphery, and the scale for the thing is set by the scale of the morphogen.
I think this unstable fixed point, which you have for stretching, that you never cross it around the perimeter.
Right, so if you did, those cells basically would die.
Ah, okay, because they would just dilate further, or?
Well, no, you basically have to say that, right, okay. It's a negative growth territory, right? You just say that they apoptose.
Okay, first?
Yep.
I do not understand the argument why you can do it with a point source instead of a line source, because this argument you're having that you're growing faster in the middle than at the outside, creating stress in the inside, sort of depends on your, as far as I understand the elastics, please correct me if I'm wrong, it depends that you're having your inside as a disk that is trying to push the outside, whereas if you're sort of in a rectangle and you're just moving the sides of the rectangle to the right.
Yeah. No, but this, remember the line, now there isn't one morphogen, there are two morphogens and both, and so there are two sources, it's more or less Cartesian system, right? Okay, there is this DPP morphogen and there is wingless morphogen, and you really need both. So
you're saying that morphogen is something like the product of the two?
Or sum of squares, or God knows.
Boris, what's the distribution number of cell proximity from your simulations? How sharp is the distribution at the end of the when you equilibrate, when the disk stops it, you get a sort of roughly fixed number.
Here's the question.
How wide is it?
What are the fluctuations? I haven't looked.
Because that would tell you how reproducible. Is there a coupling between left and left and right wing? Because they're pretty similar compared to distribution.
They would be uncoupled.
And so because between insects there is a variation, but within the same insect there is a very close similarity, so you need some kind of a couple.
They're not.
So they're not. You need some other mechanism.
Well, no, you basically hope that that this thing controls the size tightly enough to account for reproducibility.
For the same pair of instances, the same insect, but not between different insects.
That's right. But, Louis Wolpert likes giving this example of how well this is controlled, and right, so he sticks his arms out and does the same like, and so he did it once here, and there was this student, I remember well, in fact, from Rutgers, who lifted his two hands
It's because of the shock.
So it's very reproducible, but stuff happens, you know. So
what does the blue color mean in the simulation?
A negative pressure dilation.
The result you observe here also depends on the mechanics of the tissue. I mean, if, for example, you choose the mechanical form that the tissue behaves like a fluid, then
absolutely, doesn't work, mm-hmm. Right? Right. If you cannot support stress, right, you need the shear rigidity. No shear rigidity, no mechanism. So anyway, so this, as they say in biology, is only a theory. So at the very best, it's sort of just suggests some new hypotheses that can motivate new experiments. Actually, people are pursuing this. So there are sort of a number of groups who are investigating these possible mechanical effects, in particular growth regulation in disc. But nobody really has sort of succeeded in linking mechanics to control of growth. On the other hand, it's pretty clear that the sort of phenomenology of this sort of weekly mechanical distortions are there. So Loic Migov and Tamali Kui are actually looking at these discs rather seriously. They culture them in the dish. Fortunately, one can't do it for long enough to really get a good handle on it. But then they can certainly look at the snapshots and analyze the images, and at the very least look at the statistics of cell areas and cell deformations. And I think pretty much with a naked eye, you can see in all this disorder that cells on the periphery tend to be stretched azimuthally, just as you would expect. So these actually big cells are cells caught in the act of mitosis. So it turns out that when cells divide, what they do is they basically pull up the nucleus to the surface and sort of flatten it, and you'll see sort of kind of gigantic hole in the surface here. So these things are dividing cells. They'll divide and dive back into the layer. So strange things going on there. So anyway, what they see is what looks like compressed cells in the middle, so smaller cells. And then they look at the deviatoric strain, and look at the alignment of that thing, and they see more or less azimuthal distortions. So so it's the deformations that you see, but you want to know if there is actually stress. So stress is difficult to measure. In fact, the only way that people know how to measure it right now is basically come in with a laser and zap cell interface, and then watch the retraction of the neighbors. Interesting, you were supposed to see something here, but I don't think anyone can see anything here. So these guys do that sort of analysis, in particular looking at anisotropy of cell edges when they look at the periphery here, and one expects the neutral edges to be under tension, and that's what they see. They see so significantly higher apparent tension on the azimuthal ones compared to the radial ones. So, okay, so there is evidence of deformation, there is evidence of stress. Of course, what there isn't evidence of is the coupling of that to regulation of growth.
I mean, is it in principle possible to measure that for a single cell? Then we'd have better control in.
Well, I mean, the single cells are. I mean, you need an epithelial layer to really talk about what's happening here, right? And also, right, cells in the epithelial layer are different from the cell type that will be happy on its own is a completely different cell type, right? So that's important. But we'll come back to something vaguely related. So.
But inside single cells, there's a lot of variation of forces and stresses. I don't know whether you can even know what it means to have a stress at a single cell level. It can at best be meaning something of efforts over multiple.
Well, I mean, it's stress. Okay, right. So we have to do with interaction with the substrate. Right, single cells, you know, single fibroblasts are full of stress fibers and whatnot. They're basically pulling on the substrate. And, so the properties actually, come to think of it, there is evidence that, for example, cell division on the level of single isolated cells depends on the stiffness of a substrate. What place? Okay, so I just told you that it would be really nice to be able to measure local stresses, but we don't have a non-destructive way of doing that. You can come and zap the cells, but that is not a non-destructive tool. On the other hand, there are wonderful pictures and, in fact, movies these days. And so you can get these wonderful pictures of arrays of cells. And you may start wondering if one can learn something from just looking at pictures like that. And, you know, of course, for something like a soap froth, you know that the geometry of the froth would be so completely determined by surface tension, and you would be able to estimate it just by looking at the picture. So the question is, could we pull off something a little bit like that here? Well, of course you need to make an immediate important assumption. In order to do anything like this, you have to believe that the cell array is at least in approximate instantaneous mechanical equilibrium, right? Because if this thing is just flowing, then forces need not balance and need not tell us anything about, or rather geometry will not tell us anything about the forces. But let's assume that this cell array is at least in the approximate equilibrium, and let's further assume that stresses are concentrated in cortical cytoskeleton, which is more or less aligned with cell interfaces, right? So just seeing cell interface then tells us where the cytoskeleton is, and therefore, if that was the only thing in town, right, we would know that there is some force acting on this vertex, basically tangentially to the interface, right? And then we would basically want the net force to vanish at each and every vertex. This is what we're going to do. We're going to approximate this by, polygonal tiling, and have some kind of a generalized vertex model, which will basically say that this elastic Hamiltonian can basically be written as the sum of two parts. One having to do with the effective tension, that is skeleton tension in this edge, right? And that's going to be proportional to the length of the edge, and the Lagrange multiplier with edge length defines your local tension, and we'll do a similar thing for the area, right? So we'll basically say that the forces that act there can be decomposed into these cortical tensions, but also, if you like, hydrostatic pressure in the box. So again, I don't really mean hydrostatic. This is two-dimensional. So unlike soap bubbles, however, we expect that the tensions, like each cell can regulate the tensions, and in fact that there can be some local anisotropy. In principle, it can regulate the tensions independently in each and every edge. So we're going to allow, in principle, a different parameter for every edge. And
just one or two parameters, because each edge has two sides, because it's this boundary between two cells. So there are two parameters for each edge.
Well, now we will take just one, right? Right, in this energy, they'll, you're right. But in this energy, the two things will add up anyway. Okay, and similarly, we'll have a free pressure for every cell. Let's ask a question. Can we determine that many parameters just by looking at the picture and assuming mechanical equilibrium? So, the blackboard is part of my talk. So, let's do a little counting. So, we have an unknown for every edge, we have an unknown for every cell, we have two constraints for every vertex, and we have the Euler relation that links vertices, edges, and cells. And we'll assume that the vertices are sort of trivalent. So we have a relation between number of edges. Right, there are three edges per vertex and two vertices per edge. And you solve this complicated system, and you find that this is equal to that. I know I'm cheating a little bit here, but...
I mean, if you would assume that there is some bond bending...
Well, you want to give me more parameters.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, you know, if you give me more parameters, there'll be more parameters. But I want fewer parameters, not more parameters. So...
Are you insisting that the forces on every node add up to zero?
Yeah.
Oh, you are?
Yeah, no, absolutely. Mechanical equilibrium.
Okay, all right.
Or in the very least, I'm insisting that, the individual forces that act here are much bigger in amplitude than this, than the sum. Right? That's what I want. Okay, so...
here.
I just basically defined the linear problem for you, right? We have the Hamiltonian, it's linear in these unknowns, right? This is my constraint equation, so This thing is just a big matrix in terms of T's and P's, and we just need to invert it. And again, I sort of cheated a little bit. I did the counting on the torus. In reality, of course, we have an open system. So in reality, what you're going to find is the system is determined up to a boundary condition to be specified on the boundary. So one parameter per each boundary link. But then you say, okay, the number of unknowns I'm after is L squared, number of parameters is only L, so maybe we're still not doing so badly. Then another problem comes in. When you start inverting, again, you're inverting some big matrix, so you may worry about low-lying eigenvalues. So you have to worry about basically low-lying modes in this matrix, and there are lots of them, and you can have fun trying to count them, and you can have fun trying to figure out where they come from. So we had a little bit of fun with that. That's where's Kevin? Kevin was having fun with that. I guess I was also having fun with that. So the bottom line is things are not quite as rosy as I just presented them, but nevertheless not entirely lost. Especially if you're willing to make some additional assumptions and reduce the number of parameters. So, for example, let's try to actually apply it to some pictures. So, my God.
Borders.
The question is, how much do you want to know about that picture?
If we multiply everything by a factor of two, it's still going to work, right? There is a prefactor that you will never find out.
I'm sorry?
There's a prefactor you'll never find out.
Oh, absolutely.
So you won't know the tension, you will know the relative.
Absolutely.
Thank you very much. Physical numbers out of a picture or a macro.
No, but you're happy.
Yes. You can know. It's purely mechanical, purely geometrical
information. Of course.
And he's calculating dimensions,
the ratios,
quantities like tension.
Ratios.
He can get ratios.
Ratios.
He can get whatever absolute value.
Gentlemen, yes, the ratios. And you cannot get right, and the pressure is also defined up to a constant. Don't worry about it.
What did you mean by the low-lying eigenvalues causing problems?
Well, just eigenvalues close to zero. Right?
Which would correspond to zero?
Sensitivity to parameters, right? So you have to worry. How sensitive your inverse is to the geometry, right? There is some.
It's really the condition number.
Precisely. Okay. Anyway, so we looked at this picture. So this picture, there's a reason why we looked at this. It's not the only thing we looked at, but there's a reason why I'm showing this to you. So this nice epithelial tissue actually comes from the cochlea. In the cochlea, during the time of its development, so there are cells in the cochlea that are going to become neurons. They are going to become hair cells, and then there are support cells. So at this stage, there are basically two cell types in the tissue. And we thought maybe we can at least learn something about these two different cell types. So we also made, therefore, a simplifying assumption that tensions are not all different, right? We just basically assume that each cell has a tension, but this tension can be different from cell to cell. And now going back to Michael's point, we basically decompose tension acting in the edge into sum of two numbers from the neighbors, right? And of course, that reduces the number of parameters for us and makes the whole inverse problem stable. But there are some other situations where there is a good reason to believe that the pressure is the same in all cells. And then again, you eliminate a lot of unknowns, and the inverse is stable again.
Because if pressure were the same, you would not have bending lines. Your lines are kind of sometimes bending.
Not here, right? So that's the example where pressure is certainly certainly variable. Okay. So what we're going to do is, Michael, thank you very much. You already noticed that there is a clear and well-defined bending in these lines. But remember, we said that we're just going to approximate things by polygons. We're not going to look at that. So we're going to ignore this for now. We're just going to draw a little polygons. You can actually convince yourself that as far as force balance is concerned, what we're doing sort of generalizes to a little bit of bending. Not a big problem. So we do that, and we find pressures and tensions, and lo and behold, you find that these proneural cells actually do have higher pressure and tension, which you're not surprised by, because you already noticed that they're kind of round. So far so good, but now we can use that extra bit of information. So let's actually use the fact that we can measure the curvature here and use Young-Laplace law to relate the curvature and the pressure differences. Right? So the pressure differences we've calculated from this inverse without ever looking at the curvature, right? So we're just importing an additional empirical relation between tension and pressure differences here. And that's basically what we're going to do. So pressure differences are inferred, tensions are inferred, local curvature is measured, and I guess blue and red, I think, two different examples of the analysis. And so there is a pretty decent correlation. So now you can see why we looked at this tissue. So strictly speaking, what we should be doing is taking looking at fly wing discs and doing this analysis, and then coming in with UV laser and zapping edges and measuring tensions and correlating. But we haven't done that. So we had, right, we instead did this sort of theorist's consistency check.
So of course, there's something special about the cells. They look like alternating, like antiferromagnets. So what, can you tell us something about this?
I can tell you a whole long story about it.
But very
I'm not going to tell you the story about this, because my daughter is graduating, and I can't stay. I'll have to go soon. I'll be delighted to tell you the story. Okay, so in fact, I am at a curious point where I was hoping to be done by now, but I'm only halfway through, which I guess is not...
Are you surprised?
Yes, I'm surprised, because you didn't even ask that many questions.
Well, I can improve.
Well, okay. Fine, so I guess what I just advertised is this image analysis method that we hope can help us at least make estimates of local tension, right? And of course, in reality, right, this is biology, so everybody wants to know what the molecular mechanism is, and we don't really know what the mechanism of this mechanosensation and mechanical feedback is. For that matter, we don't know for sure that it exists. But I think part of the reason why we know so little about it is we really don't have any tool for even measuring local stresses. So we hope that this non-destructive tool will help. And then there are some sort of fairly obvious candidates for mechanic fixation involving some cell adhesion molecules, which then are also involved in signaling and ultimately regulation of transcription. And one can sort of start looking at localization, sort of surface localization of various components of this pathway. Okay, this and other pathways as well. And the hope is that, again, just looking at good images, we could sort of start correlating protein localization with this inferred tension. And you're probably wondering how accurate this inference can possibly be. And I assure you, it's probably not very accurate at all. But I would basically argue that what we can do, we might be able, and what we need to do, we might be able to do with sort of single bit precision measurement. So all we need to do is sort the edges into high tension and low tension bins, and then try to correlate protein localization. Is there anything different between high tension and low tension edges? So, you know, we're as physicists very, of course, enthusiastic about measuring forces in piconewtons and all that, but I'm basically arguing that even a low precision measurement of relative tensions can be quite helpful. All right, so that was the first half of my talk. And I guess you guys are used to sitting in this room forever, but, but I'll have to run out in 20 minutes. So I'm going to try to do this very fast. Okay, so this whole thing was motivated by thinking about flies, and I said that flies are so nice to work with, but it's certainly not the simplest thing to look at. And so let's try to look at a simpler case of regulation of growth, and that is just regulation of growth of epithelial cells in the dish. So epithelial cells grow in culture, and one normally seeds them in the dish, so they stick to the surface and start proliferating. And then they make kind of a dense lawn and eventually stop proliferating. And this phenomenon is called contact inhibition, and it must have been known for as long as people have been culturing epithelial cells. But remarkably, it turns out that nobody knows what the mechanism of this contact inhibition is, right? Except for the implication in the name contact inhibition, right? There's this notion that cells touch each other and signal to each other and tell each other to stop growing. So we're going to examine this, and that was actually an attempt at so theorists doing experiments. So we built this little gizmo on a low budget. So it's just obviously a microscope with an incubator, so we can grow cells on the stage for a very long time. So we have to keep cells happy. For example, we have to keep the temperature controlled. So here, temperature is controlled by a hairdryer, bought at Kmart. So for $18, you get the hairdryer with a warranty. And this warranty is good for about 2 months of continuous running. Well, we went through many returns. So it was afraid that this would happen. This is supposed to run smoothly, but it is running with hiccups. So you were seeing this time-lapse movie of cells going dense on in the dish, and it's really not running very nicely. But I think if I run it again, it will run better. Oh, this is very annoying. I don't understand why this is happening. So sometimes it runs smoothly, and sometimes it runs with these hiccups. But in any case, you saw that these things have started at low density, and the density is increasing, and you're seeing, so this is the cell, this is the nucleus. We were wondering whether it was contact or something else. So we thought that let's start basically with a single cell and watch it grow as a colony and see what happens. And again, this is not running very smoothly. So actually, this didn't start from the very beginning. We literally started with a single cell here. And this movie is basically skipping frames, and it's supposed to run much more nicely. But what we're seeing here, so these bright flashes here are actually cell divisions. And cells are proliferating in the bulk for a long time, and so this thing really goes on for a very long time.
Are so normally, similar to Pascal Silverstein's fingers in the earlier part.
Yeah. See yeah. So here are leaders.
Here are
Pascal's leaders. Right. But what we're interested in is also what's happening in the bulk. And
what kind of cells?
So these are MDCK cells. So this is dog kidney cells. So right, the same as what Pascal was using. They're really beautiful epithelial cells.
How do you get the ones that are dividing to light up?
Well, you don't need to. So here, you don't need to do anything. Remember, I told you that before dividing, they ball up. So this is just phase contrast. They ball up. They give off a little bit more phase contrast. So you actually see these very nice, nice flashes. So in any case, the bottom line here is contact inhibition normally in the dish will happen after, let's say, 5 days. It depends on what density you seed the cells. Initially, if you do it at some recommended density, it will happen just in a few days. This movie ran for 3 weeks. And the difference is that if you start with a single colony, the cells can happily expand. And right? You can go back and measure basically the area as a function of time, making sure that actually the density of cells stays constant. And what you see, so this is semi-log, so we see basically beautiful exponential growth for some time, but so let's see, after 8 days, actually you fall off the exponential growth, and that is happening because the cells in the middle of the colony have increased in density and are now dividing more slowly. And only the periphery, which is free to expand, right, free to move, continues, what stays at the same density and continues dividing at the same density. So we just sort of went on and quantified this a little bit, right? So you can, in that same movie that I showed you, so the whole colony, you can zoom in and track every nucleus. You can automatically segment this and track, right? So basically make a movie. So the only thing that is not automatically segmented here are cell division. So we had to work harder to count dividing cells, but you know, some of you know that I used to work in turbulence and so Lagrangian dynamics was my thing. So here's Lagrangian dynamics of cells. What you see are roughly two phases. So these small colonies are very motile, right? So this is basically a fluid regime. So this droplet can happily increase in area as it has to accommodate more cells. Now, so the amazing thing is this is what you see in the middle of the colony after a week or so. This is the same magnification. So the cell size is down by, or cell area is down by a factor of 10. And
The height
has gone down by about the factor of, gone up by about the factor of 2. So the volume's down.
Have they reached the boundary yet? Or is it not yet?
No, this is, okay. So it's virtually, right, it doesn't matter, right? So the density is, there is a speed limit on how fast these cells on the boundary can crawl away, right? They can only go so fast, right? But the number of cells is going exponentially, right? So the density has to start increasing the bulk, right?
And saturated.
Yeah, right. So eventually, right. So eventually it will saturate. So anyway, so what I'm trying to say is roughly fluid, roughly solid in the sense that you see virtually no interchange of neighbors, but even here you still see cell division. Right, you see these explosions here, right? These are dividing cells, but otherwise there is very little rearrangement. Again, the red stuff that you probably don't see, you were supposed to see, is automatic segmentation of this thing. So you can sort of construct a nice distribution of cell sizes and whatnot, and analyze it.
But there is net expansion still.
Excuse me?
Even in the center, there is net expansion, slow.
No. So there is no net expansion in, so that, very good. Thank you very much. That's precisely the whole point. So in the fluid phase, there is expansion. In that frozen phase, cells are getting smaller, right? So basically, once the cell, tissue gets into that phase, the density can only go up.
Right? It has to stop.
So eventually, it does, right? And that's basically what you see, right? So there are these two regimes. So here, so okay, this is not cell density, this is cell area, right? So inverse of the density. So the density is increasing. So roughly here, you go from this sort of fluid to the solid state, and after that, you basically pick up another division on average.
Do you ever observe apoptosis?
Yes.
Roughly how much?
Very little.
Okay.
You asked roughly. Yeah.
Like a factor 100 less than division, or a
few percent, I'd say. A few percent. So basically, there is still cell division at this stage, and that is balanced by apoptosis. But there is rather little of it. So.
So how wide is the boundary then in the growing? Is the colony still growing, but you just have a finite length that's doing it, and that's the size of your transition zone?
Yeah, good question. We can figure it out, but
it gives
I don't know.
This gives the pressure to which the transition occurs.
I don't think so. But okay. So you can look at basically cell cycle clock time, whatever, division time, or distribution of division times. And in this free-growing regime, right, so for a while, cell size is on average coming down, but the rate of cell division is unaffected on average, but then of course there is a distribution of clock times. So roughly, I guess the peak is something like 10 hours. Right, but then there is some critical area, and now division time is taking off, which is to say that you've crossed into a regime of inhibition. And you notice that before I was talking about mechanical feedback as stress feedback, and now in a way I've switched to not stress, but if you like, deformation. So here, of course, the fact that the cells are actually getting smaller has everything to do with mechanical constraint. But here we actually have no means of correlating cell division with actual stress. But we can very easily.
Can't you do the same analysis you did before on the network? You told us about this pretty way of doing it, so you can.
Touché. Yes. well, this was done about 3 years before we sort of came up with mechanical inverse. So yes. So in principle, one could actually go back and try to do it even there. Okay. So and then one can push this even further. So this was actually constructed by looking at lots of individual cells. This goes much, right, so this is on semi-log scale. So here we're getting actually to very low rates of cell division, right? So this went rather steeply up to 3 days. So basically this is just looking at the upturn right here, but then so it keeps on going. And so this is constructed by different means, actually looking at the distribution of cells. So first, it's a rather broad distribution of larger cells. And then with time, you eventually converge to a rather sharp distribution of small cells. And that's basically where you stay. And in this regime, cell division is balanced by apoptosis.
I know you mentioned this before. The size shrink, the shrinking of the cell is happening long before the division rate starts to go down.
Yeah. So the first thing that happens is they basically
become smaller,
compressed, and then they hit some size checkpoint. And below that size checkpoint, they go into a different regime.
I think Michael asked, is it because it reaches the boundary that they start to become smaller?
No. Why are they just in the bulk?
Why are they becoming smaller? Is there some morphogenic? How do they? What is?
No, they can't. They
pressure.
Just the pressure. I mean, ultimately, they would have to move a lot of tissue along the plate.
Pressure. Yes, they are dividing.
Well. So actually, these days, what we believe is it's not just the rise of pressure, but it's actually relief of tension. So a small colony seems to be under tension, right? So the periphery, peripheral cells are basically running off and pulling on the neighbors. So if you look in sort of small colony, and so there are these experiments done on some sort of particle. Anyway, in a soft substrate with particles in them, right? So where you can basically measure deformation of the substrate. So it basically seems that the substrate is under tension. So the whole thing seems to be under tension, at least close to the periphery.
So is there a gradient in sizes of these cells?
Absolutely.
From the periphery to the center?
Absolutely. So in the periphery, I thought I was supposed to show this, but yeah.
Okay.
So in the middle of the colony, you have different cell morphology. So you can
division rate at the edges stays high.
Yeah.
It never goes down.
That's right.
So this is sort of like your wing disk, where you have less growth because of the pressure in the middle.
Yes and no. I mean, the difference with the wing disk is, so this is a tiered layer, right? A wing disk is actually a suspended monolayer. So so a wing disk, if it was growing uniformly, at least in principle, it could happily grow uniformly. Forever. This thing cannot grow uniformly forever, right? Because it has to actually dilate and slide on the substrate to which it is adhering. Okay, so we can fool around, or rather we can and we did. You can do this on the PDMS substrate. So then you can stretch the substrate and make cells larger and ask what happens. So you can wait till they converge to a smaller station distribution, stretch the substrate into this, and then watch the distribution basically walk back. You reactivate growth into. Okay, so that's the way we used to do it. But then Lars Nagel left here and set up his own lab at EMBO and started doing things much better. So what he did was made the MDCK cell line with a cell cycle reporter. So there's a system that I don't have time to explain, which Okay, so I guess Arnie taught us about the cell cycle. So there is G1, followed by S phase where DNA is replicated, followed by G2, which precedes mitosis, and then again G1. So there is a fluorescent system which basically labels G1 cells red and G2 cells green. And so here it is. This cell we know is G1, this cell is G2. And here they go. And some red cell has turned into green, and some green cells have turned into red. And this one eventually will turn green, maybe. No, it ran away instead. Anyway, so it goes. So no longer one has to track these cells and sweat to measure cell cycle. One can just get it from colors. And here is an application of that. Okay, so what Lars and friends did was the following. They grew, so this is actually a rather gigantic slab of tissue here. I mean, not tissue, but monolayer of MDCK cells, which are contact inhibited. So this is all pretty much red, even though it looks yellow. So you actually see these little patches of green. So these patches of green are domes, right? These are MDCK cells. They're in the business of pumping, right? They're in the kidney. So they're polarized. They have apical and basal sides, and they pump from apical to basal. So they basically rather naturally blow bubbles. So when they blow bubbles, right, they detach from the substrate, and they're no longer constrained. So these bubbles, these domes, actually re-enter cell cycle. They also happen to be out of focus because they're domes. So anyway, that was just an aside. So then there was a wall here, and he just peeled off this wall and actually tore off a bit of cells. And this is what happens next. And again, the movie has hiccups. So the first thing that we see is cells on the periphery. Okay, let me. I hope it will. Okay, now it's running. So the first thing that happens, cells here start expanding. The density goes down. They re-enter cell cycle. And this went very fast. Right. So basically, fluidized. They're dividing here. In here, it's a little bit hard to see, but they've actually again. I think there were maybe two divisions between here and there, and this has become red again. So they are re-inhibiting behind the front. But now you basically have this front moving along, and the cells on the boundary are happily cycling at a lower density. Eventually, the density goes back up. So,
but there is a state of the thickness of the fluid layer.
Yeah.
Which is what?
Figure it out right from.
Calculate.
red is G2 or
he's an optimist.
Yeah, red is G1.
You're saying it's EMT, it's cell signaling, it's the differentiation of these cells?
So this is if you like, reversible differentiation of these cells. Right? And this is rather sloppy usage of the word, right? But so we had these two types of cells. That was really one type of cell, right? But it was in two states. One vaguely fibroblasty state, in which like a sort of low density state with a lot of motility. and the rapid cell division.
A large area.
And large area. And the other state, right, where there was basically no motility and very little cell division. And the moment you give these guys room to expand, they, if you like, re-differentiate from epithelial to this fibroblasty, and that of course is what you want for wound healing, right? So they restart cell cycle, they proliferate, they expand, but when they reach high density again, for reasons of mechanical constraint, they promptly go back into their epithelial nature and stop cycling. So this is the possible connection with cancer, right? Of course, cancer cells go from inhibited to a disinhibited proliferated state, and then do not come back, right? So the thought is that what's affected there is the size checkpoint. And so Arnie was talking about, I think he called it M1 checkpoint, right? So he was talking about the checkpoint involving the length of a telomere, right? So if the telomere was too short, then you don't go through F8. You don't progress in cell cycle. So here, this basically looks like the size control checkpoint. So not clear whether it's the same mechanism or what, but acting more or less at the same time, right? Blocking transition to S and G2. Larson friends, they've been playing with the system, so you can do all sorts of things. So for example, they're inhibitors of ERK2, so MAP kinase pathway, which controls transition to G2. And in that case, basically what happens is this front melts, right? These cells basically go motile and expand, go to lower density, and then it stops, right? So the expansion of the front is propelled by cell division behind the front. So you don't allow cell division, the whole thing stops. Now you're this inhibitor is irreversible, so you wash the bloody dish, and the cells in this low density region explosively re-enter G2 and divide, and the front just goes.
Why are the red cells using the opportunity to follow after? It seems that they stop half. There still is a boundary between red and green. Why is the red not thinking the same way as the original front?
I think the boundary between red and green have to do with the accumulation of RFP, right? That these cells have been sitting in G1 for a long time.
So it basically
has to do with fluorophore stability.
You should be compressing too much, you're saying, making the area smaller per cell.
But if gamma average for tumor is higher, then you'll be basically killing normal cells.
Okay.
Well, I guess all I'm trying to say is there is a normal regulatory circuit which checks for compression. That circuit is probably knocked out in cancer cells.
But could it be just
so you cannot, right? They will not respond to compression. They will still try to divide, right?
Boris, couldn't it just shift? Could your diagram of gamma versus pressure be shifted for cancer cells to be at higher pressure? That would be
yeah, that's possible.
You can still kill them, but you need much higher pressure.
Well, that's possible. But I guess what I'm trying to say is, I guess I don't really believe that there is much pressure there. It's deformation in the following sense. But so the normal tissue will stop packing before it gets into some serious steric problem, right? So this very dense tissue actually is close to the limit of dense packing of nuclei.
Okay.
So I think if you knock out this normal inhibition, it will actually generate pressure, right? Because it will continue dividing and literally pack the nuclei. I think you've had enough, and I have to go. So I'm just going to wrap up. And so we have this story of mechanical regulation of growth, and it really has a whole bunch of manifestations, right? It maybe has something to do with size determination in development. It has maybe something to do with condition. Then, of course, if true, it involves a yet to be discovered molecular mechanism of mechanotransduction, probably other things as well. And so this is just work in progress. And so we started doing this with Lars when he was here. He arrived as a theoretical physicist and left as, I guess, experimental biologist or whatever. So he has his own lab, Heidelberg. And he continues doing sort of science. Alberto was another postdoc here who arrived a little later and joined Lars. And he is actually in the Cancer Institute in Torino now. Bjarne Vöhr was another postdoc here who helped us out a lot. And he's also at EMBL now. And Deborah Feigenson here in the physics department actually taught us how to use a microscope. Hervé was then a student at the École Normale, now he's a postdoc at Pasteur. He was an intern with me, and he wrote, I guess, the first version of this vertex model simulation code. And Sebastian is a student of Lars's who actually been doing these experiments with wound healing. And Kevin, who is graduating next week and going, I don't quite know where. So you decided?
Yeah.
Okay, so he's going to Penn. So he just decided to stay in physics as opposed to go to UCSF Medical School of Junior Farm and crossing over to biology. So one strike. And various experimental collaborators who taught us things about flies. Thank you very much.
Very much.
More questions? Maybe one question and then I run.
Just, I have a general question with this contact inhibition. Maybe this is just due to hypoxia of lack of availability of the...
So the first thing you do is you change the media, and that does not...
Even if you change the media, but the media doesn't have a flow. At the certain point that you have cells, at that point of the media, it's because you have a huge number of cells. The oxygen or other things are limited, and also the membrane.
It's not free, it's too much, it's just a layer.
But anyway, I mean, above that area, others have lower oxygen or lower nutrients compared to other parts of your dish when you're culturing yourself.
Right?
No. Okay.
Unlikely.
Right.
So, so first of all, there's convection in the dish, right? It's very difficult to avoid convection. Convection is driven by horizontal temperature gradients. So there's convection in the dish. There is, isn't it? So you can certainly accumulate all sorts of stuff in the dish, but you just change the medium and stuff. You don't need any convection.
I'm confused about 2D and 3D.
This is all 3D.
Yeah, the pressure you mentioned is 2D, but when the height of cell is changing during...
When what?
The cell height changes during growth. I mean, I don't... what need to consider the 3D description? Because it is changing also in the third dimension. So I wonder why, for example, the pressure is just 2D and the description is in 2D, but there is a dramatic change in 3D as well.
I also think that's my brain is suddenly decided to turn off.
Let's go to the blackboard. Like I can convince you that you don't have to worry about that. Okay, sorry, I really have to run.